KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The leaders of both the U.S. and Israel are demanding Hamas release Israel's remaining hostages Saturday, or else. Could the ceasefire unravel? We ask a former U.S. ambassador ahead on Morning Edition from NPR News. Elon Musk is defending his controversial and legally dubious cost-cutting across the federal government. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith breaks down Musk's unusual appearance in the Oval Office yesterday. Also, speaking of government cuts, the General Services Administration will soon have its budget slashed in half. How will its work be affected? It's Wednesday, February 12th. Happy birthday to the author who asked, "Are you there, God?" It's me, Margaret. Judy Blume is 87 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is attending a NATO meeting in Brussels. The leaders are talking about Russia's war in Ukraine. Hegseth says President Trump wants to end the war, but he also says that it is not possible to regain all the territory Ukraine lost to Russia when the Kremlin first invaded more than a decade ago.
We want, like you, a sovereign and prosperous Ukraine. But we must start by recognizing that returning to Ukraine's pre-2014 borders is an unrealistic objective.
Hegseth says that there must be a, quote, realistic assessment of the battlefield. The Trump administration has fired another inspector general. This one is at the embattled U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. That inspector general's office had just put out a scathing report on the administration's freeze on U.S. foreign aid, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
USAID Inspector General Paul Martin received a brief note from the White House giving no explanation as to why he was being fired. The move came a day after the inspector general issued a report warning of the consequences of Trump's aid freeze and the administration's efforts to dismantle USAID. It says these moves are making it more difficult to track the humanitarian assistance that is supposed to continue to flow, to make sure there's no fraud and abuse, and to make sure it doesn't benefit terrorists in the Middle East. The USAID Inspector General's office has employees both in Washington and at embassies abroad with large USAID missions. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Separately, eight former inspectors general at federal agencies are suing the Trump administration. They were, among many others, fired suddenly late last month. The eight former IGs allege President Trump broke the federal law by failing to inform Congress ahead of time and for failing to give clear reasons for their dismissals. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has threatened to resume hostilities in Gaza unless Hamas releases hostages as scheduled this weekend. Hamas said earlier that it would delay the hostages' release and accused Israel of violating the ceasefire. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
Netanyahu met with his security cabinet for many hours, a meeting that was moved up after Hamas announced the delay. In a speech afterward, Netanyahu demanded that Hamas return the hostages as planned, or the ceasefire will end and the Israeli military will resume intense combat, he said. Earlier, President Trump had demanded that all the hostages be released by Saturday, a proposal very different from the current agreement, or, quote, all hell is going to break out. A senior official with knowledge of the matter not authorized to speak publicly later clarified to NPR that Israel expects three hostages released Saturday, as previously scheduled. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
It's NPR. The government says consumer prices rose by 3% in January over what they were a year ago. The report is a little worse than what economists expected. The data show inflation is stubborn and may influence Federal Reserve policymakers to hold interest rates where they are rather than cut them. Forecasters say another winter storm is pelting the central plains this morning. The storm will drop several inches of snow. Areas from the southern plains to the Ohio Valley could also get dangerous ice. This week's Billboard charts are out. NPR Stephen Thompson reports what's called the Grammy bump is happening.
The new number one album in the country is Hurry Up Tomorrow by The Weeknd. The Weeknd is one of many artists who rose on this week's Billboard charts following their performances at the Grammy Awards earlier this month. While The Weeknd's album is brand new, older albums by Chappell Roan, Benson Boone, and Doechii also rose dramatically on this week's charts. But maybe the biggest boost of all went to the Grammy's Album of the Year winner. Beyoncé's Cowboy Carter had dropped all the way off the Billboard 200. This week, it re-enters the chart at number 19. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
There's a winner in the Best in Show at the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show. A giant schnauzer named Monty was crowned the champion. He bested six other finalists to win. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. The federal government is about to get a lot leaner. The General Services Administration, which keeps the government running, is facing deep budget cuts and new surveillance measures on employees. We'll have that story in just a few minutes. First, though, President Trump is again warning Hamas it must release all the remaining hostages who were seized on October 7th.
I don't want to do two, and then we do another two in another week, and then we do four and 3 weeks. No, no. They either have them out by Saturday at 12 o'clock or all bets are off.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has also set a Saturday deadline while threatening to end the ceasefire in Gaza and, as he put it, resume intense combat. Three hostages were scheduled to be released this weekend, with nine in total still believed to be alive and part of the first phase of the deal. So is the agreement for Gaza unraveling? Let's bring in Dennis Ross. He's a former American envoy to the Middle East who served as the point man on the Mideast peace process in the administrations of George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
So let's start with laying all this out, because these ultimatums from Trump and Netanyahu came after Hamas said it would delay the next hostage release, and it did so after accusing Israel of reneging on the terms of the first phase of the agreement. So where do you think this leaves the ceasefire in Gaza?
Well, it looks fraught by everything you've just described. I'm not sure that this first phase of the ceasefire won't still go ahead. It's very interesting that yesterday Prime Minister Netanyahu echoed President Trump. Then there was a background, unattributed statement by a senior official, presumed to be Netanyahu, saying all the hostages had to come out. And then a short while later, there was another statement released in which it said, no, it would just be the three. There's signals from Hamas that they're prepared to go ahead on Saturday. I think what we're going to see is this will go ahead for now. Netanyahu's under enormous pressure from the far right of his coalition, which basically wants to resume the war, But he's also under enormous pressure from most of Israel, because as the Israeli public has seen hostages released, including the most recent releases in which the hostages looked emaciated and looked as if they were Holocaust survivors, that has not reduced the pressure to get all the hostages out who are still alive. The idea that he would not pursue that when there's still a chance to do so, I think, creates a huge pressure on him. So I think, at least for the moment, we'll probably see this go ahead, but whether or not you can complete the first phase and go into the second phase, I think that's a huge question mark in my mind.
Okay. Now, this isn't the first time President Trump has threatened similar consequences. He vowed that there will be hell to pay unless the hostages were freed before he took office, and just before Israel and Hamas agreed to that ceasefire. Do you think this kind of strategy is effective?
I think it was effective before he became president, because it gave leverage, I think, to Egypt and to Qatar. They could go to Hamas and say, look, if we can get this stopped before he comes in, it'll be difficult to resume the war once he's in. That's one thing before he becomes president. Now that he's president, the idea that all hell will break loose from a Hamas standpoint, they can say, what can the Israelis do to us that they haven't done already? Now, they may want the respite. I think they probably do, and they certainly want to see the war end, because that's their chance in their mind to somehow recover. But the fact is, at this point, there's not a whole lot that Israel can threaten to do that they haven't done already. And it's not, there's nothing that the United States can do that Israel hasn't done. So I don't see how that per se affects Hamas. Again, the question in my mind is, does it create more of an incentive to Qatar and Egypt, who do have some leverage on Hamas? That may be the one area where what the president threatens actually has an effect.
What did you make of President Trump's suggestion to remove all Palestinians from Gaza? Did he think that made things worse?
Well, I don't think it helped it from the standpoint of, are we going to get this done now? The irony is, what it reflects is a kind of look at this problem, I would say, from a practical standpoint. How are you going to rebuild Gaza when you have 2 million people there? It was a kind of a practical standpoint, but it didn't reflect, I think, an understanding that Palestinians, Arabs, fear the way the Israelis want to resolve the conflict is by having all Palestinians leave. That's not sustainable in the Middle East. There is a practical issue here. Has the president raised something that gives Arabs a reason to come with a constructive, practical, tangible alternative, and not just one with slogans?
That's former U.S. Ambassador Dennis Ross. Ambassador, thanks.
You're welcome.
The General Services Administration manages most of the federal government's contracts and real estate, but its budget will soon be cut in half.
Yeah, the remaining employees have been told they will be closely watched while they're on the clock, and this could be a model for what might happen across much of the entire federal government.
That's according to reporting from NPR's Jenna McLaughlin, who joins us this morning. Good morning.
Hi, Lula.
Hey, so the GSA probably isn't a household name for a lot of people. Just walk us through why it's so important.
Sure, yeah. GSA doesn't often make the headlines, but it is really important. A source told me to think about it this way. It's basically the federal government's circulatory system. It pumps blood to the rest of the body. Without GSA, federal agencies would have a really hard time doing things like buying anything or accomplishing their mission. They buy real estate, they get supplies for the government, but also manage nearly all of the government's contracts. So it runs kind of like a business. If GSA is impacted, that's going to trickle down to the rest of the government and eventually to normal people who are seeking public services.
Okay, so you describe these really important functions. So what does a 50% budget cut at an agency like GSA look like?
Yeah, so sources at GSA spoke to my colleague Shannon Bond and I on condition of anonymity about all this. They're not allowed to speak to the press, and they were really scared of being further retaliated against by Trump officials. But listen, Layla, what they told us is that there's going to be big job cuts, canceled contracts, terminated leases. They're still figuring out the particulars of how to get to that 50% number. But there will be three requirements to keep your job. Is it required by law? Is it critical to the mission? And lastly, does it generate revenue? Remote work is all going to be over by March 3rd, but it is kind of unclear where employees around the country will actually go into the office. That's because GSA wants to consolidate all its regional and local office space into 4 or 5 major hubs across the country. you know, inevitably there's going to be more and more legal challenges to what's going on. The deferred resignation offers we've been hearing about and these firings that have been happening without cause or notice, you know, but everything's moving so fast, it's hard to keep up.
Yeah.
And, you know, by the way, at the end of the day, it's unclear how much all these major changes are going to cost.
So a lot changing, a lot unclear. We're hearing from a lot of federal workers, they're not taking that resignation offer. They don't trust it. What happens to the people who are left when the dust clears?
Yeah, that's really important. Our sources told us that GSA employees in some departments have been specifically told by their managers that going forward, everything they do on their work devices is going to be heavily surveilled. You know, of course, most government and corporate-owned devices are subject to some monitoring. That's part of the deal of being employed. But this is really above and beyond. One of the most disturbing things sources told us is that employees would have what's called a keylogger put on their computers. Those programs track every single thing that you type.
Wow.
It's super invasive, yeah. But technical experts at GSA also told us it's a big cybersecurity risk, depending on whether things like passwords or other sensitive information is retained or stored elsewhere. Other surveillance might be monitoring of when employees log in, their badge swipes, their chats. Meanwhile, staff in DC can't just swipe into the office anymore. They have to go through a full security screening.
So really a sense of being constantly watched. How does all of this fit in with the larger changes that the Trump administration is making across the federal government?
One of our sources said that they were told this is the Trump plan for the rest of the federal government, with some small exceptions. So the 50% cuts, the ramping up of pressure, this constant surveillance we've been talking about. You know, Leila, we might be having the same conversation again soon about a different agency.
NPR's Jenna McLaughlin, thank you for your reporting.
No problem.
A federal judge has ordered the government to restore websites and data sets maintained by federal health agencies. The decision comes after the Trump administration began abruptly pulling them down last month, actions that provoked loud and swift outcry from across the public health and medical fields. Here's NPR's Will Stone.
The Trump administration's sudden decision to yank these websites sent many scientists and researchers scrambling to preserve data sets and backup material. And it prompted a lawsuit against the Department of Health and Human Services and some of its agencies, including the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
The agency decisions here were completely unreasoned. They just suddenly tore down the pages without any justification.
Zachary Shelley is an attorney with Public Citizen Litigation Group, part of a nonprofit consumer advocacy organization. They filed a lawsuit on behalf of Doctors for America, a left-leaning advocacy group representing physicians. All kinds of pages went offline. Information on HIV testing and prevention, guidelines on contraceptives, data sets that show vulnerability to natural disasters and emergencies.
It basically makes it harder for doctors to treat their patients.
In response, the judge granted a temporary restraining order and told the government to start immediately restoring the websites brought up in the lawsuit and documenting what else had been removed. Last week, many of the web pages that had initially gone down did come back online, but it's still not clear what's missing and what has changed. The Department of Health and Human Services did not reply to NPR's request for comment on the judge's order, but previously a CDC spokesperson cited President Trump's executive orders on gender and on diversity, equity, and inclusion as the rationale for taking down the websites. Dr. Joshua Sharfstein and others who sit on a CDC advisory committee wrote the agency's acting director protesting the purge of data.
These were really important health resources. These are not just like books on a shelf. These are like heavily thumbed through manuals that people really need.
And he says he expects the federal government to follow the court's order. Will Stone, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
on the next Fresh Air, how Elon Musk got and is using the power to cut jobs / federal funding and help place people close to him in government positions. What influence are other tech billionaires having on the Trump administration? We'll talk with New York Times reporter Teddy Schleifer, who covers the intersection of Washington's players and tech titans. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. From Cunard, sailing to destinations worldwide on Queen Mary II, Queen Victoria, Queen Elizabeth, and Queen Anne, with the goals of relaxation, indulgence, and adventure. Learn more at cunard.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The late dance company founder Alvin Ailey's signature work, Revelations, tells a story of faith and perseverance set to a suite of traditional Black American spirituals. Since its premiere in 1960, it's been seen all over the world by millions of people. But it turns out that the original version was twice as long as the one performed today. Now the Ailey Company has returned to those roots with a new work called Sacred Songs. It's set to new interpretations of the songs that were removed. It's on tour across the U.S.
Wonder where is Doubting Thomas.
Matthew Rushing, a longtime dancer with the company who is serving as interim artistic director, created the new work. He is with us now in Washington, D.C. And joining us from New York is musical director Dubois Akin, who arranged the songs. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Matthew, I'm going to start with you. You could not possibly have performed in Revelations when it was first created.
No, not at all.
So, do you remember when you first saw it?
I most certainly do. I was 13. I'm originally from Los Angeles, California. I saw it at the Wiltern Theater. I had recently been baptized at a beach. So if you can imagine a 12 or 13-year-old sitting in the theater, seeing concert dance for the first time, and what he sees is a image of something that just recently happened to him in his own spiritual journey. It was mind-blowing. The fact that I could see excellence in dance articulate experience I had just recently went through, and that was it for me. At that moment, I was like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life.
You are behind the effort to bring back these parts. How did you even know about this?
We were approaching the 60th anniversary of Revelations pre-pandemic. We were trying to figure out how to celebrate it. And I was reading Mr. Ailey's biography by Jennifer Dunning. That's when I found out that the piece was originally like twice as long as it is right now. There were live musicians and singers on stage. Some sections were not danced to. They were just vocal offerings. Learning all this, that was kind of like my entry into, hey, what if we resurrect these songs that were actually originally taken out?
Why were so many songs taken out?
Well, soon after the premiere, Mr. Ailey and the company went on tour, international tour at that. So to have a piece so large, he had to condense it in order to travel with it.
So Dubois, this is a good place to turn to you. In returning to these songs, was it always your intention to refresh them or update them?
Yeah, we always knew from very early on that we wanted to reimagine, and that gave me a lot of room for play and exploration. And even when I went to interview the 40-something people that I interviewed to find the right musicians, I knew that I was looking for people who were technically gifted, but also were rooted in these traditions of jazz and gospel and could explore with me to find this new sound.
Oh. when Revelations was first performed, you know, it was kind of a documentary of the Black experience. You know, many of the people performing in it would have had the experience of a river baptism, or maybe their parents would have, or what we would call getting happy in church.
Mm-hmm.
Different now.
Exactly. And what's so interesting about that thought is that also goes into the challenge in the work. As we rehearse and we bring younger generations into the company, there's a lot more coaching and information has to be given so that a younger generation can find a really clear connective point so that they are performing in an authentic way as well.
Could you give us a sense of what is different about these reimagined versions of these songs and what the public might have heard at the 1960 premiere of Revelations that originally included them?
Yeah, I love that opening clip that you all played of Wonder Why, formerly known as Wonder Where in the original Negro spiritual, because it is one of the pieces that we wanted to play with, this idea of tradition versus modernity. If you've seen Revelations or if you've heard any Negro spirituals, there's a certain kind of verbal and sonic language. We wanted to stretch these and say, how can we make this into a hip-hop song? What would this sound like in funk? What would this sound like as a rock and roll song? The African-American experience is still grounded in the human experience. Yes, there's struggle. Yes, there's pain. Yes, there's lament. But there's also joy. There's triumph. There's resolution.
When I watched the performance, there were moments that people actually gasped. Can you describe some of the specific movements in sacred songs and what they signify and how they reference what's in Revelations?
Definitely. You'll see dancers washing their hands and then sometimes even washing their faces. There's this idea of cleansing oneself. And I even brought it further when I was working with the dance artist. I was like, right now we live in a very challenging time. Sometimes we need to cleanse ourselves of the thoughts and the feelings that don't serve us. So if you see sacred songs, the last image is the dancers circled around a pool of water, washing themselves, cleansing themselves of thoughts and feelings that will not serve them.
Matthew, you know I have to ask this. Do you miss performing?
Yes, I do. I do. I'm not going to even lie.
That's Matthew Rushing. He is a longtime dancer and now interim artistic director at the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater. He was nice enough to join us in Washington, D.C., where the company was on tour. Joining us from New York is musical director Dubois Akin. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
If you've ever felt the urge to tune out the world's crises, you have something in common with the narrator of the new novel, Stone Yard Devotional.
It's something that has really preoccupied me as a writer, that the question of how much should I be in the world, how much should I be out of the world.
I'm Ari Shapiro. What do we owe the world and each other? On All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. U.S. inflation is up. The Bureau of Labor Statistics finds the consumer price index rose to 3% in January from the year before. Prices rose by 0.5% from December to last month, higher than what was widely projected. The Federal Reserve's target is 2%. In his second day on Capitol Hill, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell is telling members of Congress that while inflation has fallen significantly during the last 2 years, there's no hurry to continue cutting interest rates.
We know that reducing policy restraint too fast or too much could hinder progress on inflation.
President Trump seems to disagree on Truth Social. Today he writes interest rates should be lowered and would go hand in hand with upcoming tariffs. Funding for federal agencies expires mid-March, once again setting up the government for a possible shutdown. Meanwhile, the Senate's pushing a border security, energy, and defense bill with plans for a separate bill that covers the extension of tax cuts. NPR's Barbara Sprunt says the Senate's two-bill approach is at odds with what the House leadership wants, border, energy, and tax cuts in a single bill.
They're worried that if they delay the tax component and put it in a second bill down the road, it could be jeopardized altogether. House Republicans have a razor-thin majority, and it's hard enough, frankly, to satisfy all factions to get on board with one bill, let alone two.
NPR's Barbara Sprunt reporting. The Dow is down more than 400 points, or nearly 1%. You're listening to NPR News. Britain's King Charles is hosting a rare guest at Windsor Castle tonight, the Vice President of Sinn Féin. NPR's Lauren Frere reports on the significance of the event involving the Irish political party that once had ties to militants and wants independence from Britain.
Michelle O'Neill is the First Minister of Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom and saw decades of Catholic Protestant fighting. Her father, uncle, and cousins were all in the Irish Republican Army, or IRA, which used violence in its struggle for independence from Britain and assassinated King Charles's great uncle in 1979. Now, nearly three decades after the Good Friday Peace Agreement, O'Neill is dining with the King at Windsor Castle, along with the First Ministers of Scotland and Wales. Those two were also spending the night, but O'Neill declined that part of the invitation. She also attended Charles's coronation and his mother Queen Elizabeth's funeral. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Frontier Airlines made a third offer to acquire its budget rival Spirit Airlines, but Spirit's not biting. Instead, the rival budget carrier says it's working on emerging from bankruptcy. It has a court hearing tomorrow. Spirit anticipates restructuring will be completed in the first quarter. The Dow has fallen more than 400 points, or nearly 1%. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California. The latest cover of Time magazine imagines tech billionaire Elon Musk seated behind the Resolute desk in the Oval Office. It's a nod to how much power he's wielding in Washington these days as he looks to slash the federal government. Now, yesterday, the world's richest man appeared in the Oval Office, though it was Donald Trump sitting behind the desk. The two men promoted and defended Musk's work. For more, we're joined now by NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Tam, describe that scene for us.
Well, Musk was standing beside Trump, who was ready to sign an executive order that outlines a role for Musk's Doge project in significantly culling the federal workforce. And also, Musk's young son was there the whole time. At one point, Musk put him up on his shoulders, only to have the kid start sticking his fingers in his dad's ears, which interrupted things. This was the first time that we've seen Musk on camera with Trump speaking at length about the unit known as the Department of Government Efficiency, which is upending Washington and spawning lawsuits claiming that what he and his team are doing is illegal.
So did they address those lawsuits? And what did President Trump say about whether his administration would comply with court orders that are holding up his agenda?
Yeah, it's a big question, one that has legal scholars warning of a potential constitutional crisis. There have been a number of preliminary rulings and injunctions in recent days where federal judges have found that some of these actions and executive orders appear to violate laws or the Constitution. Yesterday, Trump complained that an activist judge wants his administration to stop looking for waste, fraud, and abuse.
We want to weed out the corruption. And it seems hard to believe that a judge could say, we don't want you to do that. Well, so maybe we have to look at the judges because that's a very serious, I think it's a very serious violation.
It's not clear what case he's talking about there, but later when pressed by reporters about whether he would disobey a court order, Trump said he abides by the courts and he would just have to appeal the rulings.
Okay, so let's turn to Elon Musk now. He and his team have been plowing through agencies, gaining access to their computer systems, also looking to make cuts. A lot of questions, though, about what his team is really doing. So did any of that get cleared up?
Musk talked about strangely specific things like payment categorization codes being missing from Treasury payments or the antiquated way that retirement paperwork is processed. And then he also offered platitudes about deficit math.
What are the two ingredients that are really necessary in order to cut the budget deficit in half from $2 trillion to $1 trillion? And it's really two things, competence and caring. And if you add competence and caring, you'll cut the budget deficit in half.
He offered shady-sounding descriptions of financial malfeasance, but Musk really hasn't detailed how what he is doing adds up to the billions of dollars that he's claiming he has already saved the American taxpayers.
Yeah, and just to be clear, he offers no evidence of that financial malfeasance. Now, his companies include SpaceX and Starlink. They do a lot of business with the government. Do they address potential conflicts of interest there?
Both Trump and Musk dismissed concerns. Musk said he checks in with Trump regularly to make sure he's okay with what he's doing. And Musk argued that transparency is the answer to concerns.
I fully expect to be scrutinized and get a daily proctology exam, basically. I sort of just camp out there. It's not like I think I can get away with something. I'll be scrutinized nonstop.
Colorful language there, but Musk is filing a confidential financial disclosure that the public won't be able to see. He claimed that everything the Doge team is doing is being published on its website, but that site is literally just an all-black page with a golden dollar sign and the words, Department of Government Efficiency, the people voted for major reform. Really, the only way the public is learning about what the Doge team is doing is from posts that Musk and a Doge account are putting up on X, the social media site that Musk owns.
All right, that's NPR's Tamara Keith. Tam, thanks.
You're welcome.
The third AI Action Summit has wrapped up in Paris, France. The global summit was initially conceived as a way to get world leaders together to talk about AI safety following the rise of tools like ChatGPT. But it's becoming less and less about safety. As NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram reports, U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance was there this week to discuss the Trump administration's stance on the technology.
From the start of his speech in Paris, Vice President Vance was clear on what he wasn't going to talk about.
I'm not here this morning to talk about AI safety, which was the title of the conference a couple of years ago. I'm here to talk about AI opportunity.
Vance's remarks come as President Trump has been criticizing the more careful and wary approach the Biden administration took on artificial intelligence. Vance echoed that in his speech, but instead of attacking Biden, he warned countries against collaborating with U.S. adversaries, and he attacked Europe's policies on regulating technology, like ones that limit hate speech and disinformation. Vance said the rules make it a burden for U.S. companies to work in Europe.
We need international regulatory regimes that fosters the creation of AI technology rather than strangles it. And we need our European friends in particular to look to this new frontier with optimism rather than trepidation.
Vance's speech was followed by action. The U.S., along with the United Kingdom, refused to sign on to the summit's declaration for inclusive and sustainable AI practices. But countries like France, India, China, Canada, and dozens others did sign on. A White House official who spoke on the condition of anonymity said it would be, quote, inappropriate for the U.S. to sign on to the agreement before Trump's own AI action plan is developed. But there are risks to the U.S.'s isolation on AI policies, says Ifeoma Ajinwa, a professor at the Emory School of Law.
I don't think the U.S. should stand alone. I think the U.S. is risking being left out of all the benefits of collaboration and cooperation.
She says not being involved and committed to AI development with global partners could mean that the U.S. gets left behind. There's also a risk that China could fill the gap if the U.S. exits the global conversation on AI safety, says Gregory Allen. He runs AI at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
While there is some reason to be concerned about the risk of overregulation, completely throwing out the baby with the bathwater on AI safety and security issues could be an opportunity for China to show more leadership on this area.
And that should be a concern, says Allen, because China's growth on AI is fast moving. The latest release of their generative AI model, DeepSeek, shows that U.S. leadership on AI isn't guaranteed. But for the Trump administration, the answer to keeping an edge on AI development is the less focus on safety and regulation, the better. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
Indian Prime Minister Modi goes to Washington to discuss defense and trade with President Trump. We'll discuss the relationship next time here and now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, me Martinez. A chocolate relic was discovered recently at Cambridge University Library, an old orange wrapper from a crunchy bar, a chocolate-covered honeycomb made by British chocolate company Fry's. The wrapper is suspected to be at least 50 years old because the price on it, 6 pence, indicates it was printed before 1971. That's the year the UK currency became decimalized. Now the library wants to know who discarded the candy wrapper, asking the litter bug to fess up. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Some states are trying to lower electricity costs for low-income households through community solar projects. These allow people to use a portion of renewable energy from a shared system. Here's Monica Samayoa from Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Carlos Interian lives with his family in an apartment complex in a northeast Portland neighborhood.
We just use the internet, the TV. We turn on music for the kids to entertain them.
But his energy bills have gone up to keep the family entertained and warm this winter. He pays 25% more than he did 2 years ago. Right now, he pays at least $100 a month.
I don't make enough to pay the bills.
That's because he recently injured himself on the job as a mover. But Interian will soon get help lowering his energy bills by joining a new community solar project that's expected to come online next month. Late last summer, thousands of solar arrays were installed on 3 acres of industrial land near the Portland International Airport for a unique project.
This is the first of its kind in Portland. There have been many other community solar projects in the state.
That's Evan Ramsey. He directs renewables for the nonprofit environmental group Bonneville Environmental Foundation.
Community solar provides the same utility bill credits as rooftop solar without the requirement that you own your roof or that you have good solar exposure.
Some of the power will go to the Port of Portland, which provided the land for the project. The rest will help 150 low-income residents in a predominantly Latino community, including Interian. The goal is to help lower their energy bills by up to 45%. To do that, Ramsey's organization teamed up with other nonprofits to get subscribers specifically for this project, rather than the generated renewable energy going to all utility customers. That means that Interian and others subscribe to get solar credits through the program toward their utility bill. Interian could save more than $500 a year by signing up. He says that's wonderful.
Qué maravilla.
Community solar like this one aren't new. The idea first started in Colorado in 2010. Since then, other states have been building out their own community solar projects. Currently, there are more than 3,400 of them in most states. That's according to National Renewable Energy Lab researcher Sudha Kannan. She says that all those projects power nearly 2 million homes, helping alleviate demand from the local power grids.
It seemed like a win-win-win, I guess. It benefits consumers. It can benefit the developers, utilities. Of course, larger benefits to community as well.
What's more remarkable, Kannan says, states like Alaska and Minnesota have passed legislation that ensures low to moderate income households can also benefit. But it's not all green lights for community solar projects. Kannan says these projects can run into siting and permitting issues. The whole process can take a long time, and
not everyone is able to engage in that kind of long times to get the project up and running.
And some states like Pennsylvania, Alabama, and West Virginia don't have community solar. Kannan says there could be a number of reasons, including opposition from utilities, who would lose profits by a third-party-owned project. But in Portland, community solar projects are expected to grow in the next 5 years. Ramsey's organization recently received more than $30 million to build out more of these projects to help low-income residents and people of color lower their energy bills. For NPR News, I'm Monica Samayoa in Portland.
This is NPR News. Thank you. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. It's been 6 months since Mpox was declared an international health emergency, but it still continues to impact a dozen African countries, with about 900 new cases confirmed per week. Now, experts say the outbreak stands at a critical moment, as the halt on U.S. foreign assistance, along with rebel violence, scramble efforts to control the spread of the virus. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel reports.
Goma is a city that's known hard times. It's in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, a region plagued by conflict and violence. The city is surrounded by overcrowded camps for displaced families and mining towns with transient workers. This is where Mpox infections were really taking off. It's a highly contagious disease that causes painful blisters and can be deadly. So, governments from across Africa to Japan, France, and the U.S. came together to help the DRC get the outbreak under control and keep it from spreading to other parts of the world. Paulin Nkweser works for UNICEF in Goma. All that effort, he says, it was starting to make a difference.
We were just managing, and I think the outbreak was even going a little bit down.
One big piece of the response is a vaccination campaign. The U.S. had pledged 1 million doses of the Mpox vaccine and $500 million for the containment effort across the region, for things like training health workers, diagnostic tests, gloves and gowns for staff working in dedicated treatment centers.
We have around 140 Mpox patients who were in isolation in the Mpox treatment center around Goma.
Then, late last month,
from one day to another, everything has just collapsed.
One of the rebel groups took over Goma, and when they did, the Mpox treatment centers were looted, and more than 100 patients fled for their safety.
After the fighting erupted, we managed to locate only 15. So the rest is probably living within the community with a huge, huge risk of contamination.
Contamination, meaning the virus spreads. Mike Ryan is with the World Health Organization.
All of the investment we've made over the last number of months to establish Mpox surveillance, Mpox control, Mpox vaccination, all of that is interrupted, on hold, and impossible to continue.
On top of that, President Trump froze almost all U.S. foreign assistance, including work done by the United States Agency for International Development. USAID had been playing a key role in Mpox control efforts. I spoke with two people who worked on the Mpox campaign. They requested anonymity for fear of retribution. They said after the funding freeze, U.S. involvement in the outbreak ground to a halt, and hundreds of thousands of Mpox vaccine doses are now stuck in a warehouse far from the DRC. One source compared the unraveling of the U.S. Mpox effort to watching a train wreck in real time. The White House did not respond to requests for comment.
It's a critical moment, for certain.
Anne Ramoyne is at the University of California, Los Angeles, and has worked on Mpox in the DRC for 20 years.
DRC has a very fragile health system, and USAID is an integral part of this fabric that is already stretched very, very thin.
And she says without U.S. support, there will be disastrous setbacks for health in the DRC. And because diseases don't respect borders, she worries those setbacks could be felt elsewhere in the world, too. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
For over 50 years, a network of nonprofits has sent free books to people in jails and prisons across the country. But last year, several states, including Missouri, Arkansas, and most recently Tennessee, barred these groups from sending books to prisoners. Char Dastin from member station WPLN in Nashville reports fear of contraband is limiting access to books.
The Appalachian Prison Book Project lives in an old stone house in Morgantown, West Virginia. It sends books to prisoners in six states.
We get about 200 letters a week from people incarcerated asking for books that they like to read.
Lydia Welker is one of the lead volunteers.
They might ask us for a certain author or a genre or a specific title that they want.
Then a volunteer checks the supply of donated books and tries to send the best possible match. State prison systems control who can mail books to prisoners. They have a list of trusted book vendors, and until last April, Appalachian Prison Book Project was on Tennessee's list. Welker says that's when something unusual started happening.
We got 4 tote bags worth of books returned from state prisons in Tennessee that same day.
It turned out the Tennessee Department of Correction, or TDOC, had taken all the books to prisons programs off its approved vendor list. Now, a prisoner who wants a certain book has to get someone else to buy it from just a few authorized online booksellers. A spokesperson for TDOC said in a statement that the change was made to stop contraband from coming through the mail. But Moira Marquis, who wrote a study on prison censorship for PEN America, says research doesn't back that up.
We know from available evidence that it's roughly 2% of all contraband that comes into facilities comes in through paper mail.
That's all paper mail, not just books. But screening mail and books takes time and labor. And in Tennessee, many prisons are chronically understaffed. Kelly Brotzman directs the Prison Book Program in Massachusetts, which serves all 50 states. She says this change will shrink the number of prisoners who get new books.
Because you don't have the internet as an incarcerated person, you can't order them. Plus, you don't have any money.
Prison libraries aren't usually a good option either. PEN America says they're often small and not frequently updated. Tennessee prisoners say they've noticed the change. Brian Hurst is serving a life sentence. He says he used to get books from a church and that reading in prison changed him. He wrote me, "I found escape, and in that escape, a newfound purpose, a drive in life I did not before possess." That kind of personal growth, Tennessee native Lorenzo Comboa Irvin says he saw it too when he was in federal prison in the 1970s. At the time, the only books allowed at all were Bibles. He helped lead a lawsuit that ended that restriction. Then he started a reading group.
People who had been gangsters, it changed their focus entirely. Instead of the use of violence, it allowed people to understand that there was a new possibility.
Tennessee corrections officials say programs can still send books by donating them to prison libraries rather than mailing them directly to prisoners. But advocates say that's not a reliable way to get a prisoner their requested book. For NPR News, I'm Char Dastin in Nashville.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin.